It was 1540, the first time members of the Cherokee Nation saw Europeans. An expedition commanded by Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto. Luckily for the tribe, the expedition was just passing through. But as the years passed, other expeditions came. They and other tribes did not fare as well. Future expeditions brought settlers and the building of forts and fortified towns. Although the Spanish eventually drew back in the interests of even more lucrative conquests, word had gotten out and it had spread. Enter the English, who not only brought more adventurers and incursions onto Cherokee ancestral lands, but also an escalation of violence, not only in the face of the least show of resistance, but unprovoked attacks as well. But that was not all. For a great viral killer that the English had developed an immunity to began to sweep through the Cherokee Nation, killing more than half the population and leaving many others disfigured or ill for life. This made it all the easier to set entire villages to the torch, killing the well along with the sick, and wiping out all vestiges of the disease before the English settlers seized the lands and rebuilt settlements. But the warring against the Cherokee Nation continued due to its sheer size, as it was, and amazingly still is, one of the largest of the Confederated Native Nations. Yet even that was not enough for those who wanted still more, or found that there was valuable resources on Cherokee lands. And thus the Indian Relocation Act was signed into law by that well-renowned humanitarian, Andrew Jackson. And it led to over 20 years of forced relocations of a number of nations. From 1938 into 1939, it was the Cherokees' turn. With the forced migration known as the Ustiganana Dasiguasti, or the Trail of Tears, a series of forced marches of up to 4 months and nearly 1,000 miles from the Tennessee and the Carolinas all the way to Oklahoma. Of the approximately 16,000 Cherokee who were driven like human cattle on those marches, anywhere from 2,000 to 8,000 died along the way. There was no way to know for sure, for the army personnel on contracted Indian herders never bothered to keep an accurate count. But this is where my family history comes in. My great-great-great-grandmother, Marinar, was Cherokee. And when she and her twin sister, Leonara, were little girls, they lived in a village near the South Carolina-Tennessee border. We don't know if they were fraternal or identical twins, but according to the stories passed down from my maternal grandmother, the two were absolutely inseparable. The birth of twins is a more rare occurrence among Native American tribes, generally, than in the general population. So they were something of a novelty, which brought them even closer. But that closeness ended abruptly when my great-great-grandmother suddenly became very sick, and no one knew why. According to the story that has been handed down in my family, the tribal medicine man couldn't tell whether she'd been bitten or stung by something, eaten something that was poisonous, or contracted a disease. But my grandmother felt it had something to do with her reproductive system, because not knowing what else to do, they eventually sent her to stay with her grandmother, who was learned in herbs and natural medicine, especially those of benefit to women. And she had returned to her original tribe further into South Carolina after the death of her husband. whatever her grandmother did, it had worked. But she had to stay for several months. And just when Mahanara was to be returned to her parents and sister, the tribe received word that Mahanara no longer had a home to return to. The enforced marches had begun, and Mahanara never saw her sister or her parents again. In considering the stories of indigenous suffering in this country and around the world, we see a parallel in the experiences of Job. He had a good reputation around town, and he was honored by God, and he didn't engage in evil activities. By all reports, he was pretty much all-around good guy. Sounds almost too good to be true, doesn't it? But that's the story that's come down to us, and who am I to doubt it? Job was a good man, doing his job, whatever that was, supporting his family, and being a good husband to his wife and father to his children, and perhaps having some good, clean fun with his friends. But meanwhile, unbeknownst to him, something was brewing up in heaven he would have wished they'd known about. But he was going to find out soon enough. Now consider the heavenly scene for a moment. All the heavenly beings have come to pay their respects to God. And who shows up as well? But Satan. Okay. Well, there are very few references to hell in the Bible, and almost all of them in the New Testament. So let's charitably assume that Satan had a free pass to come up to heaven whenever he wished. Or perhaps he was summoned, but let's not get too enmeshed in such questions of possible power dynamics, or we'll be here all day. If not hell, Satan at least had been knocking around on earth, and it was his opinion of God's beloved human creations that God wanted to challenge. Now, there's a bit of a backstory here involving God, Satan, and Job that we're not getting that seems to be influencing the present actions. We have enough to go on, however, to know that Satan had tried to incite God against Job before, and both have something they still feel they need to prove. And so God commends Satan to reconsider Job, extolling his sterling qualities and lifting up Job as a well, him-fearing man. He goes on to add that Job has always turned away from evil and implies that he simply cannot be tempted. Uh-oh. Now, either God had forgotten he's talking to the infernal dark lord of temptation himself, which I doubt, or he's pretty darn sure of his hand. But Satan doesn't buy it and says, and he says so. So God puts Job in Satan's power with the one caveat that Satan spare his life. But Satan doesn't care. He doesn't feel Job needs to die to prove his point. He figures he can get Job to cave way before that. Well, he can't wait to get started. He is Satan, after all. So what does he do? What? He inflicts hideous sores all over Job's body. But some things you can't just scrape away with a piece of broken pot, as Job soon found out. And he's tested for the first time when his wife tells him to just curse God and die. You know, you just don't find loving partners like that anymore. But Job doesn't miss a beat in responding that in faith, as in life, you need to take the good along with the bad, the challenges along with the blessings. Score, Satan 0, God 1. So important a lesson in faith is this, of great challenge, is the story of Job that It goes on for the next 3 weeks in our lectionary. But fortunately, we don't have to wait until then. We can find related perspective among our readings today in Psalm 26, which, according to some scholars, was written by our old friend King David, and by others, by an unknown supplicant during that Babylon captivity. It really doesn't matter which, as what's important is that he addresses another facet of this same concern, a stage we will see Job live into in the weeks ahead. The writer wishes to assure us of God's love and approval, and himself as well, and with a shade of desperation born of doubt, for he jumps right in to remind God of his integrity and his faith. And he offers to prove himself further if that's not enough. And he does something that many of us still do. Human nature really hasn't changed that much over the past several thousand years. He compares himself favorably against those he deems less pious. He avoids like the plague those he considers to be worthless, the hypocritical, evildoers, and the wicked. Instead, he washes his hands in innocence, even as Pilate would do many years later, singing loudly to the Lord songs of praise for his boundless largesse. "Do not," he says, "kick me to the curb with those sinners. I'm not like them." Why would God allow Satan to punish a good person like Job? And would he similarly punish our psalmist? I don't know. I don't have all the answers. No preacher or pastor does. I wish I did. I wish there was something that I could do or say that would make some kind of a difference in this messed up patriarchy of a society that puts sexual abusers and predators on the Supreme Court. But this is where the thorny concept of theodicy comes in. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people and allow bad people to be rewarded for their misdeeds? Sometimes, and I just got to say it, ineffability sucks. Tomorrow is Indigenous Peoples Day, a compassionate successor to Columbus Day in its paean to colonialism. Although I concentrated on the Cherokee Nation in my opening story, it was just one front of what became to be defended by European apologists as manifest destiny. The same thing happened with other indigenous nations and tribes across the country, just as it occurred before and has been taking place ever since around the world. Wherever dominant cultures found it advantageous or just took cruel pleasure in oppressing indigenous populations. It didn't happen all at once in this country, of course, any more than it did anywhere else in the world. But it has been going on for a long time, beginning in the middle 1600s, and is still going strong even today. It's shocking to people that don't know, and even to us that do, how little known or reported it is that Native Americans on reservations are being killed by American law enforcement at even a higher rate than police shootings of African Americans. There's no purpose in engaging in the oppression Olympics. It's a game that no one wins and everyone loses. However, it is indicative of the sheer immensity of the problem and the deep roots that make the paradigm extremely difficult to shift. But we're making progress. We really are. Despite resurgence and escalations of racial prejudice, oppression, war, and other violence, and 1,000 other ways, we could do so much better than what we are doing. We are moving forward, even when it doesn't seem like it. But it's not a straight line on a graph. There are plenty of dips along the way, much darkness that has at times eclipsed the light. And I'm not saying it's not going to get darker before it gets lighter. It may. It might take bottoming out or coming dangerously close before we finally get it. Now, Martin Luther King once said, paraphrasing the words of Theodore Parker a full century before, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it does bend toward justice." But God created light for a greater purpose than just physically illuminating our world and the whole darn universe. She created it as a beacon for our spirits. For just as a single candle dispels the darkness around it rather than being subsumed by it, so does God's light promise ultimate illumination and redemption and eternal freedom from the darkness of consciousness humanity has fallen into. It is the best of times and it is the worst of times, as Charles Dickens once said. Each age is. And for now, we go on. But for how much longer can we keep repeating the cycle until it crashes under its own weight of endless repetition? But at each juncture, we have a new opportunity to break the cycle. And it may well be that the seeming worsening of all around us means that the time is now, that we are the crux of transformation. Just as a caterpillar whose cocoon is about to burst, we're not approaching end, but a new beginning. And it's a freedom for all people, the indigenous and the colonizer, the oppressed and the oppressor. It won't happen overnight, and it doesn't happen in a vacuum of inactivity. It will take the combined effort of each one of us in every word we utter, every action we perform, and even every thought we give power to. And so we call to you, God, Great Spirit, not only to guide us, but to open our mouths to speak with your words. And open our ears to listen when it is another's words that need to be spoken and that we need to hear. Use our hands, our feet, our minds as you will, for service to you is service to others and to ourselves. Nazgi Wendigosada. Amen.